It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha, who's being featured today, before he was the Buddha. So last week, we talked about the five fundamental archetypal qualities in the story of Siddhartha, the Buddha, before he was the Buddha. And they were the choice between worldly and spiritual pursuits. Should he be a king, or should he be a monk? Or awakening to the truth of suffering, home leaving, ascetic practice leading up to the middle way, and complete enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. Those are archetypal elements common to many other beings who achieved what Buddha achieved. So we covered the first three last week, and today we'll do the last two. This fourth one being his arduous ascetic practice for 6 years. He followed Siddhartha, followed the common Hindu practices of his time, and he studied with the two leading contemporary Indian teachers. And in both cases, he completely mastered everything, and to the point where they wanted to hand over their congregation to him. It happened twice. And both times he refused, because the state of mind that he achieved through their meditation techniques, and this was kind of the last word in India at that time of meditation techniques, he completely mastered them. But when he did, he thought, well, I can understand the benefit of these states that I can get into, but they're not doing anything for old age, sickness, and death to kind of face those things and overcome those things. And so he refused, and he continued on his own path. And sometimes in pictures of the Buddha, when he was practicing these ascetic practices, one of which was fasting, you can see his ribs. He's very gaunt and so forth. He really, let me read you some of the practices. Never eating afternoon. So all your food is like, there was one meal and it was before noon, and that was it until the next day, but until before noon. Never lying down, never carrying money, strict celibacy, prolonged meditation, numerous prostrations, sometimes severe fasting, and another one was never to go indoors under shelter. The aim of these things were to totally purify and expunge all worldly desires and defilements, and to transcend attachment to the physical. Buddha felt like, so finally Buddha was so starving that he could barely like wash himself in the river and then get out of the river. And the story describes him at the point of death, really, when he was offered milk by a cowherd and then rice pudding by a sympathetic maiden. Well, I've told you I told you Thich Nhat Hanh's version, which is very adorable, of a young maiden, not a cowherd actually. She was given food to feed the forest gods by her mother, and then she came upon the Buddha, not even able to get out of the river practically, and so she gave him what her mother had given her for the forest gods. That's another version. I love that version. So anyway, greatly refreshed and with renewed health from this nourishment, he decided to sit in contemplation without moving until he realized the end of all suffering. I mean, just imagine that. Imagine sitting down, determined to realize the end of all suffering, which means birth and death. He was after the end of the cycles of birth and death. Why do we have to do this? That was his question. Why do we have to have old age, sickness, and death again and again and again? It's ridiculous. And so a lot of people don't even understand that that's what Buddhism is. You know, it's a method of getting beyond suffering. And what Buddha discussed, and what we're going to talk about in this series starting next time, is his mental phenomenology of suffering. So he discovered so the next thing he did was he sat down under a fig tree and he determined not to get up until he had found the answer to this cycle of suffering that human beings have to go through. Within the ascetic thing, he discovered the middle way, which is that it doesn't help to go without food, for example, to starve oneself. All those things don't help. It's the middle way that helps. It's the middle way between ascetic practice and hedonistic practice. We can say the middle way, but a lot of different groups have a different understanding of what the middle way is. There are, for the Theravada monk, the middle way lies between obedience to a million strictures, and at the other end, priests in the Mahayana, our tradition, as developed in Japan, the middle way can include marriage and a marginal degree of comfort. So the point is not to be caught by worldly material pleasures, but also not to be caught by extreme acts of denial. That excessively extreme and austere behavior is also an entrapment. So neither one of those extremes work, and that's what the middle way is. That's what Buddha discovered as the middle way. He discovered that by getting food after starving himself. So that's the fourth archetypal behavior of Buddha that is like other, there are other great beings who have also gone through that same thing. And the last one, the fifth one, is his sitting under the Bodhi tree, vowing not to move until he could solve the problem of suffering. And some accounts say he sat there 7 days, some say 7 weeks. We still commemorate this seven. And when we have a 7-day sesshin, that's very common. And that's a commemoration of Buddha's, let's say, 7 days under the Bodhi tree. So he sat in meditation and he reviewed the dhyana system of meditation. And he contemplated the mental phenomenology of suffering that he later taught as the 12-fold chain of causation, what causes suffering. And that's what we're going to study in the next 8 lectures. The 12-fold chain of causation, causation of suffering. So this is, see, he figured out while he was sitting under the Bo tree how we think our way, think and feel our way into suffering. I mean, it's an amazing discovery. And so we really have to know this. So these talks will be, they will be mental, but I'll give you a lot of help. And there's a chart that you can download and have right in front of you of all 12 links. And I'm sure you'll be able to easily understand this. So as Siddhartha sat under the Bodhi tree, he was faced with a lot of temptations from Mara, who is the personified spirit of obstructive delusion. And she attempted to unseat him with worldly power, with intimidating demons, and with enticing women. And throughout it all, he remained unshaken and unmoved, intent on his meditation. And his unshaken resolution is emblematic of the dedication of all bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas are very determined, even though they have a goal or a cause that's they will never achieve. It's unachievable. For a last ditch effort, Mara challenged Siddhartha by demanding to know how he could claim that he was awakened. How do you know? And Siddhartha responded by calmly touching the ground before him, calling the earth itself as witness. And this gesture, I have a statue. This gesture is known as the earth touching mudra. And it's memorialized in many images of the Buddha sitting cross-legged in meditation with his right hand outstretched, fingertips touching the ground. So I don't know if you can see this, but this is a earth-touching mudra. This is the mudra I'm talking about. It's actually a common version of statues of the Buddha. I hope you can see this. I have it right by my desk. Some versions of the story state that the earth goddess thereupon emerged from the ground herself, verifying Siddhartha's qualifications for awakening. This touching the earth and the emergence of the earth goddess reveal the quality of Buddhism as an earth religion. It's really a central factor of bodhisattva practice. Everything we need for awakening is present in the very ground upon which we sit. Enlightenment is not a matter of achieving some kind of brand new state of being or consciousness, or traveling some distant realm, or becoming a different person. It's a transformation embodied in Siddhartha's awakening. It's simply about fully settling into the deep, wide self we already are, totally interconnected with the whole universe, but expressed uniquely in this individual life. This experience is as close to the ground beneath our feet. It's as close as the ground beneath our feet. It's not achieved in some external heavenly realm. The earth we sit on is rich and fertile, teeming with life and awareness. So after he defeated Mara and continued sitting through the night, the morning star appeared, and when he saw it, he was thoroughly awakened. And the nature of this enlightenment is described in the Mahayana as Buddha's realization that all beings fundamentally are expressions of the clear, open-hearted awareness referred to as Buddha nature. Although some may not realize it due to their conditioning or ignorance, when Siddhartha awakened, the whole world and all its creatures awakened together. So Shakyamuni's enlightenment was the beginning of Buddhism, not its end or conclusion. Thereafter, he started a movement known as Buddhism later, and he devoted the remaining four decades of his life to teaching. So practice doesn't stop with enlightenment. Although this was the culmination of Siddhartha Bodhisattva's career, and the beginning of his Buddhahood, in another sense, Bodhisattva work begins with and assumes this enlightenment. It is said that Siddhartha's first students were the five companions who had pursued austerities with him. And then when he took nourishment and adopted the middle way, they departed from him in disgust, assuming he had abandoned his spiritual quest. And some Mahayana accounts state that these five had been following him since he left the palace, and that they in fact were noble courtiers sent by his father, Siddhartha's father, King Suddhodana. Although they were inspired to follow and join the prince, they continued to keep the palace informed about his activities. So later, when they saw him after his awakening, they recognized and appreciated a new quality in his bearing and became his first disciples. One of the most defining stories about the nature of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is in the Lotus Sutra. And as Shakyamuni is preaching the Lotus Sutra, Bodhisattvas who have gathered from many distant dimensions of space, time, and mind ask Buddha if they can help preserve his teachings for beings in the distant future after his passing. What's coming is really interesting, I think. The Buddha tells them, don't worry. And suddenly, from out of the empty open space under the ground, spring vast multitudes of noble, gentle beings dedicated to the emancipation of all creation. The Buddha declares that these bodhisattvas practice diligently within the earth, forever guiding confused worldly people like us. Moreover, they have trained intently with him, even though many apparently are ages older than the Buddha himself. So seeing this vast array of previously hidden bodhisattvas, Buddha's disciple, the bodhisattva Maitreya is the next incarnated Buddha. So we're basically waiting for Maitreya Buddha to incarnate and become the next Buddha who's actually a person on the earth. So, but at this time, when the incarnated Buddha was Siddhartha, our Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, Buddha's disciple, Maitreya, voices the question of the whole assembly. So Buddha has just said that he's trained all these gentle beings who have come out of the earth to teach all of us endlessly. And Buddha said, I've trained all these people. And so Maitreya expresses the question that everybody's thinking but not saying. Maitreya said, given the limited number of years, sir, since your departure from the palace, how could you, and awakening from the Bodhi tree, how could you have trained all these people? Thereupon, the Buddha proclaims that although it may appear that he was born and left the palace and attained enlightenment and taught and would pass away into extinction of parinirvana, in reality, a Buddha's lifespan is inconceivably vast. The regular archetypal events of his life are only displayed for the benefit of beings in accord with what would be most helpful to their development. Ultimately, a Buddha's lifespan is nearly eternal, inconceivably vast beyond our imagining. While Buddhas may seem to arise and disappear, there is actually no place or time where there are not Buddhas. The implication is clear that bodhisattvas too, springing up out of the ground, are everywhere and in every time with inconceivably long lifespans. This is especially true for the cosmic bodhisattva archetypes. So there are also cosmic bodhisattvas and Buddhas, and then there are incarnated bodhisattvas and Buddhas. And the Buddha is telling us that they spring up from under the ground to help all beings all the time. And we just, in our ignorance, aren't aware of them. The flip side of the story, also proclaimed by the Buddha in a pivotal episode of the Lotus Sutra, is that there's a helpful aspect to seeing the Buddha as mortal and an ordinary person, not a superhuman god. Historically, it's recorded that Shakyamuni died at age 80 from dysentery, probably after eating tainted pork accidentally offered by a well-meaning lay devotee. As a mendicant, the Buddha ate whatever he was offered, which is a traditional policy of Buddhist monkhood that sometimes outweighs general preferences for vegetarianism or for avoiding killing animals. So although he had realized the end of suffering as a historically manifested human with a limited body, the Buddha still was subject to sickness, old age, and death. In his recorded death, Shakyamuni was calm, teaching to the last, encouraging his awakened disciples to realize that all conditioned things pass. That's why he had to die. It was a teaching method. He had to teach his students that all conditioned things are impermanent, including this body of Buddha's. It's impermanent. So his body needed to die to make that point. So we can't ignore the aspects of Buddhas and bodhisattvas as regular mortals subject to the limitations of physical incarnation. Buddhas and bodhisattvas were previously people just like us, but simultaneously, awareness and awakening of Buddhas and bodhisattvas is always present, never dying, ever available to help all beings. So both truths live together. So there are two truths. A further archetypal aspect of Shakyamuni's life, central to the Zen branch of Mahayana, is the legendary story of his mind-to-mind transmission of the true Dharma eye to Mahakasyapa. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. It's Mahakasyapa or Mahakasyapa, I'm not sure. While preaching to the assembly at Vulture Peak, the Buddha paused and silently held up a flower. This is a very famous story. And all in the assembly were perplexed, except for Mahakasyapa, who smiled. And Shakyamuni acknowledged the response of Mahakasyapa, stating that he alone understood and thereby received Buddha's true Dharma eye transmission of the wondrous mind of Nirvana. In the Zen tradition, this tale is considered the first transmission of the teaching, and Mahakasyapa is considered the first ancestor in the lineage. And although this pattern of transmission is not recorded in extant Indian writings, in China and the rest of East Asia, it became the basis for lineage records, tying contemporary masters back to the historical Buddha, and is also the basis for the forms of Dharma transmission in the Zen tradition. So, for example, along with this Raksu, where it's written in the back in Chinese, there's a piece of paper that's folded up, so you never want to unfold it, with every single lineage member from Shakyamuni to me, that's all. That's, I have a piece of paper that links every single Shakyamuni, Mahakasyapa, and et cetera, Huineng is in there, and Dogen is in there, da 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 da, until Gale. Actually, it's my Buddhist name, Sanrei Esho. So that's never forgotten. This lineage thing is not forgotten, and the lineage is transmitted mind to mind, from teacher to student. And in this case, it was transmitted through taking of the precepts. This happened in a precept ceremony. So I received the precepts from Suzuki Roshi, and in doing so received a Dharma name. And that Dharma name has a lineage all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Okay, and then the next thing I have to mention before stopping is Dogen, who is an archetype of Shakyamuni Buddha. So think of it this way. So all Buddhist monks are considered home leavers, just like Shakyamuni. But the story of the 13th century Japanese Soto Zen founder, Eihei Dogen, particularly exemplifies the Siddhartha archetype, because Dogen, whose voluminous writings are considered pinnacles of Zen philosophy and literature, he was also born into a family of high nobility, probably descended from an emperor. And he was also trained for an important political position. So he could have just walked in to a very high political position, just like Shakyamuni. He could have walked into being king. Like Siddhartha, he was awakened to the truth of suffering. And in Dogen's case, he was awakened to the truth of suffering, seeing the incense rise at his mother's funeral when he was 7 years old. And that awakened him to the truth of suffering. So then he left home. In his early teens, Dogen disappointed his noble relatives, who had set him up to be a noble, have a noble career. He abandoned his birthright of political leadership to enter the monkhood in the Tendai school of Buddhism. But later in his 20s, like Siddhartha with his contemporary Indian religious teachers, Dogen felt his spiritual questioning unsatisfied by all of the contemporary Japanese Buddhist teachers. He did the same thing that Siddhartha did. So Dogen, he couldn't find a teacher to satisfy him in Japan, and he pursued his quest in an arduous and that time physically perilous journey to China. And after feeling dissatisfied with a number of leading Chinese teachers also, Dogen finally found his master, whose monastery he trained diligently, determined not to leave until his quest was satisfied. And by the way, all of these Buddhist teachers with whom he did not find satisfaction, they were all Rinzai Zen teachers, the ones in Japan that he couldn't be satisfied with were Rinzai Zen teachers, and the ones in China also. He almost came home without satisfaction. But these Chinese teachers who didn't satisfy him were Rinzai Zen teachers. And his Nyodo, his own teacher that he finally found, was a Soto Zen teacher. I'm just telling you this. It's interesting. So he trained with Nyodo very diligently and determined not to leave until his quest was satisfied, in this case, enlightenment. And so ultimately he had a deep awakening experience before returning to Japan. And after struggling to find an appropriate way to share his experience, like Shakyamuni, who worked to find skillful means for effective teaching. Shakyamuni worked really hard on skillful means for effective teaching. And he was really good at it too. What skillful means, he shaped his teaching to the person to whom he was teaching. So he assessed and he just intuited what that person was able to understand, and he taught that. He taught according to what he intuited the person would be able to understand. So it was an incredible skill. This is the Buddha now, Shakyamuni Buddha. And Dogen established, Dogen's skillful means was to establish a monastery and train successors to continue as the Soto lineage of Japanese Zen Buddhism. And Dogen's writings exemplify penetrating wisdom, and his teachings stress meditation practice as an expression and celebration of awakening. And this is Zazen. We really get Zazen from Dogen. And Nyodo, we have to acknowledge this. So I have, I want to just tell you what I think are the seven most important points that I just talked about to be sure to remember. The first one is, as Shakyamuni sat in meditation, he reviewed the dhyana system of contemplation, and he thought about the mental phenomenology of suffering, which he later taught as the 12-fold chain of causation. So mental phenomenology means the mental process that we go through that leads to our suffering. What do we do to create our suffering? And that's what Buddha discovered. It was just absolutely amazing. So he realized that the world and its round of suffering are produced by a chain of causation leading from fundamental ignorance to habituated mental predispositions, which means habits of thinking and feeling in a certain way. So we go from ignorance to certain habits of feeling and thinking. And he figured all this out. And I have a chart, which I'll give to you. Some of these are felt as distasteful and others as desirable, and such likes and dislikes lead to craving and grasping at the object of desire, which produces frustration and suffering, and the cycles of old age and death, birth, old age, and death. So that's the first important point. And the second is how Mara challenged him, demanding to know how he could claim to be awakened. And he responded by touching the earth and calling the earth itself as a witness. And some say the earth goddess herself emerged from the earth. That's one of the stories surrounding this. So that's the second point. And the third is his enlightenment was the beginning of Buddhism, not the end. That thereafter, he started a movement later known as Buddhism, and then devoted the remaining 4 decades of his life to spiritual teaching. And spiritual teaching in this very attuned to the student way. He was super attuned to his students. And that goes with the Soto Zen way of teaching. Fourth, as he was preaching the Lotus Sutra, and many bodhisattvas gathered from all time and space everywhere, he talked about, you know, how can he preserve the teaching after his passing? That was a question to him from these beings. What can we do to keep these teachings? And the Buddha said, don't worry. And suddenly from the ground came all of these bodhisattvas who were going to be constantly renewing the teaching of these teachings. And this is all the mystical aspects of Buddhism, which I love so much. This is the kind of mystical side of Buddhism. And there is one, and it's very profound. That's the fourth one. And the fifth one is the Buddha proclaiming, and this is also mystical, the Buddha proclaiming that you might think that I was born and left the palace and died, but actually the life of a Buddha is inconceivably vast. The regular archetypal events of his life are only displayed for the benefit of beings in accord with what would be the most helpful. But actually, while Buddhas may seem to arise and disappear, there's no place in time where there are not Buddhas. And the implication is that this is true for bodhisattvas also. And the sixth one is this tradition particularly emphasizes the personal experience of awakening and the role of a teacher as guide and witness to providing verification and the depth of a practitioner's realization. And it's found in the mind-to-mind or face-to-face encounter with a mature teacher. So we still hold to this mind-to-mind transmission of the teachings. It still takes place today. And this last, the seventh and the last is, although all Buddhist monks are considered home leavers, the story of Dogen, particularly almost point for point, exemplifies the Siddhartha archetype. It's very wonderful how those two stories come into play. And then here are 5 ideas for your reflection this week. First, reflecting on Siddhartha's refusal to take the offers to take over the 2 leading Indian teachers' congregations, because he recognized that the progression into lofty, ethereal mental realms did not ultimately lead to the complete liberation from suffering that he sought. One is aware of how precise he was in his knowing of what he sought. You know, like these meditations, they may be nice, but they're not the end to suffering. I'm looking for the end to suffering, birth, aging, and death. I want that. I don't want just wonderful mental states. So this quality of precision plays a large role in determination. Do you know exactly what you want? And do your efforts to get it make the same beeline as Shakyamuni? And give some examples of your succeeding or not succeeding. You might even give an example of an obstacle and how you approach your obstacle. So that's the first question, to bring it home to yourself, that you saw Buddha, the story of Buddha, make a beeline for what he wanted, which no one else had done. So it was like weird, let's say, that he wanted this. What? You know, you're trying to figure out the end of life and death. You know, who do you think you are? Like that. It was really super weird. But he did it. And because he was so determined. And I'm asking you, look at your own determination and see, where is it? And also, where is it not? And where are the obstacles? And how do you handle all that? Second, it's easy to see when you look at the gaunt Buddha with ribs sticking out, that he's not following the middle way. But how about us? Where do we go overboard? Where do we lose the middle way in our own lives? And so is your life out of balance? That's this question. Is your life out of balance? If so, where? If not, how does having your life really balanced help you in your thinking and in your life in general? How do those very balanced middle way habits help you? So that's the second question about going overboard or having your life be out of balance in some way. And third, taking the Mara part of Siddhartha's story as a lens to your own life. How do you let things distract you? I mean, Mara was all about distracting the Buddha from his purpose. Oh, look at this gorgeous woman. All these things. How do we get distracted? And what distracts you? And I noticed, I know, when I established, tried to establish my daily writing practice. I mean, I did. But boy, I noticed that every single day, I thought it was unbelievable. Every single day, as soon as I made that intention, there was a really good reason to skip my writing period and just do this other important thing. And I just determined I didn't care. I was going to have a writing period no matter what. And I don't know that ever went away. It just seemed like almost every day there was a really good reason to skip it. It's terrible. You set an intention that isn't like money making, and all of a sudden there's a really good reason to skip it. So look at that. That's the third question. Look at that. Your distractions. What are they, and how easily are you distracted from your intentions? And the fourth one is, this is about the transformation embodied in Siddhartha's awakening is simply about fully settling into the deep, wide self we already are, totally interconnected with the whole universe, but expressed uniquely in this individual life. And the question I have for you is, what's your idea of enlightenment, let's say, or awakening? What is your idea? Try to capture it in words. What are you thinking enlightenment is, actually? Is it a surprise to hear that it's as close as the ground under your feet? So that's the fifth question, the fourth question. And the fifth one is about food. As a mendicant, the Buddha ate whatever was offered. That was Buddhism, to eat whatever is offered. And it outweighed, to eat what's offered, outweighed preference for vegetarianism and the avoidance of killing animals. And so how would you describe your own policies around eating? Because this is an area where there's usually a lot of discrimination. And it's especially good to be conscious of it, because we're going to be talking about how discrimination, likes and dislikes, are maybe the thing that we need to stop doing in order to stop this mental phenomenology of suffering. I hope you pay close attention to these five questions, and maybe even, like one student, have a document on your computer where you answer them intentionally and keep a record of your answers. And they're always posted on the website, so you don't have to remember them. Well, in the name of time today, I'd like to ask if there are any questions, and you can include questions from last week's talk also, because I think we were short of time last week also. Please ask your questions.
Thank you, Gail. The first one that we have is, when you said the Buddha, after his enlightenment, spent the rest of his life teaching, how did the Buddha actually teach? I mean, what did his teaching look like?
You know, this is a really good question, and it's amazing that it's asked, because I'm rereading a biography of Suzuki Roshi. And on Suzuki Roshi's very first talk in America, he answers that question. And I have it here because I'm reading it now. And let me read this to you. So this is Suzuki Roshi. This is Suzuki Roshi talking now. He said, his very first talk to his Japanese congregation, so it's probably in Japanese, he said, when Shakyamuni Buddha first started to teach 2,500 years ago in India, he lived in the forest and would at times give talks to all who came, monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen. Many, many people came to hear him, since he was so great and his talks were so wonderful and liberating. When he stepped up on his dais, a monk would hit a tree stump with a mallet, and his disciple Ananda would say, "We are now going to hear Buddha's talk, so please listen carefully." And Buddha would deliver his lecture. When he finished, the monk would pound the stump again, and Ananda would say, "The Buddha's gracious talk is finished." One day, the people came, Buddha arrived, and the monk hit the tree stump, and Ananda said, "We are now going to hear Buddha's talk, so please listen carefully." But that day, the Buddha just sat and didn't say a word. Then he stood up. Ananda said, "Excuse me, O Honorable One, but are you not giving a talk today?" "Oh, but I just did," the Buddha answered, and he descended his dais and walked away. And apparently Suzuki Roshi then stood silently for a moment, and then with a stick in his hand and his palms he used to carry the staff, he got showed and thanked the congregation and left. This was maybe to early audiences, and later he had gigantic audiences, but I think this actually is more what you're thinking. And that's how the Buddha taught. It's a little bit surprises me. I sort of thinking of him. I mean, I'm sure he did this also, but like one-to-one of someone on the street asking him for teaching, and he'd pull the person aside and say something. Usually it was something about the Four Noble Truths, actually. He taught the Four Noble Truths a lot. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Gail. The next one that we have is, how does having determination, like the Buddha's, wanting to find a way to end suffering, align with the idea of goalless practice? Are they at odds?
No. I know it's a very understandable question, but they're not at odds in the same way that when I was writing poetry, I simply arrived at my desk. I gave away the merit of this practice to all beings, and then I just sat and waited for my words. And I didn't have any idea of making a poem, or this was going to be so great, or someday I'll write a book, or even when I had a contract from Penguin for, this is for One Continuous Mistake and two other books, I just ignored the contract, and I arrived at my desk and I gave away the merit and I just sat. And so there was a practice involved, and my determination was the determination of the practice, the determination to do the practice. In the end, it led to 40 books or so, you know, maybe 30 plus books. But I had no idea of that. I had no idea of that. And someone said, gosh, you're really prolific. And I just like, I never thought of that word. So there's a difference. It's subtle, but there is but it's actually a big difference in using your determination to have a practice, whatever your practice is. This is why I encourage you to make everything you do into a practice. Don't do anything unless it's a practice. That's how I live, because I lose interest if it's not a practice. I kind of don't care anymore. So whatever you do, make it into a, you know, brushing your teeth. I have a practice of brushing my teeth. Da da da. Etc. I mean, just make it into a practice, because then it's goalless. Then it doesn't have a goal, and it's not about yourself, because in Buddhism we have no self. And so if you do things to feature yourself, like I'm this person who's going to achieve this goal, but that's a delusion. You're not that person. And so in Soto Zen, we try to not live by delusions as best we can. And here's one way. So it doesn't interfere. Having a practice, so long as you turn it into a practice, then it doesn't interfere with, it's not the same as having a goal. And your determination is to do the practice. I hope you understand. It's the best I can do. And it is subtle, but it's definite. Thank you. Thank you for asking.
So the next one that we have is, last week you said that since we are here listening to these talks, probably we too have had at some point an aspiration to care for and help suffering beings. You know, these talks feel very relevant to me, but I don't think I've ever had an actual moment like you're talking about. I mean, I care about people who are suffering, but more in a general way, not in a way that I intend to devote my life to helping them.
The aspiration to care and to care for and awaken all beings is considered mysterious and auspicious. And the ways of the Dharma are mysterious. This is really important. This is a totally important point. For example, the way I should have told you the story already, but I'm going to say it again. And if I haven't, you might be surprised that the way that I started these teachings right here on Zoom, these teachings came from a tarot reader. I just don't remember if I told you the story or not, but this is a perfect example of how mysterious and auspicious the ways of Dharma. Dharma is mysterious and auspicious. So I went to a tarot reading and I had some question, and I really highly regard my tarot reader. And she's in the middle of answering my question. I don't remember what it was. And she's interrupted herself and she said, "Gail, you have to start teaching." And I said, "What? What are you talking about? Teaching what? What are you talking about?" And so she proceeds to answer my question and she interrupted herself a second time. And she said, "Gail, the cards are screaming, you have to start teaching." And then I thought, well, the only thing I could think of to teach was about Buddhism. And then immediately, you know, I'm not the only person here. There's three other people involved in this endeavor, whom I thank every single week. And I will today, because they're a very important part of this package here. And it all fell into a place like in over one weekend. And then I figured out what I wanted to talk about in like immediately. The whole thing happened in like a weekend from a tarot reading. I mean, go figure. If the ways of the Dharma are not mysterious and auspicious, you know, there you have it. That's all you need to know right there. And so what I want to tell you is that you may be looking in the wrong place for signs. It could show up in the kind of books you read, in the kind of people you hang out with, in the kind of like being kind to strangers. It can show up like in different places. It's not in one way, like this showed up. That's the Dharma showing up. So keep your eyes open. That's all I can say. Maybe you have a too fixed an idea of what it's going to look for. And now I see I absolutely have to stop. And I absolutely have to thank Brendan and Sahar and Brian for all the things they do to make these talks possible. And also for you for coming to hear my talks. That makes these talks possible. And for those of you who listen during the week, I so appreciate your taking the trouble. I thank you all. And I hope I will see you next week when we begin the kind of nitty-gritty chain of causation. Bye-bye.